battery of his iPhone. "He put poison down," she was saying. "They might die inside, and then you have to sweep them up and put them in the bin. There's something weird about this house, you know. Today, when I was changing Blake..." "Are you listening to me?"
"Yes."
He looked back up at her, like a soldier in line before his colonel. "You haven't even been home for 5 minutes and you're already staring at your phone. Can't you just be here now that you're finally here? Can't you just be present?"
"I am present."
Melissa thought that when Michael was looking at his phone, he was basically just sitting there doing nothing, but she was wrong. When he was staring at his phone, as she put it, he was not just staring at his phone. He was looking for more exciting jobs he might apply for. He was checking for important messages, checking the news, keeping up to date with Barack Obama and Lewis Hamilton developments, checking house prices in less crime-ridden areas they might move to, buying music, getting a recipe for chicken patties, and now, very usefully and imperatively, he thought, asking Google for any surefire tips on eliminating mice. Everything, life, was in his phone. A whole world of information and activity. She was so yesterday. She was so prehistoric. But still hopeful of a peaceful evening, he put the phone back in his pocket and walked to the kitchen to make her see that he was actually here. All of him. She was holding Blake on her hip, and she kissed him with her tight lips, which untightened for the moment of the kiss. Blake, the immediate transformer, a little wizard, the fact of him a wand. "He said we have to put wire wool in the holes on the outside of the house," she carried on, wiping the countertop with a frantic motion, "because they come in from the outside to use the house as a feeding chamber. So we need to buy some wire wool. It's wool, made of wire."
"Okay. Are you feeling all right?"
"I'm fine."
"Okay."
Michael was hungry. His stomach was growling. He opened the cupboard, looking for food. There were some crackers, some apple rice cakes. There was a pot of rice cooking on the hob, but nothing to go with it, apparently. Not that he was expecting her to have cooked him dinner, hell no. He opened the fridge. A box of eggs. Michael did not like eggs. Some pulverizations in little Tupperwares. Some condiments and a few other things like that. And a fromage fray the size of a thimble. "God, there's no food, man," he said. Melissa bristled inside. Her inner man-hating despiser of patriarchy was computing that he had just berated her for not maintaining their domestic plenty during her non-working day. "What?" she said.
"What?"
he said. Because in fact, he had been half-speaking to himself, exclaiming, rather, at the lack of existent munchies, which he always liked to indulge in on arriving home from work, ravenous. But she didn't see it that way. "Are you complaining?" she said, bearing down on him, or bearing up, because she was short, but it felt like bearing down. "That I haven't made you some dinner?"
"No,"
he said.
"It sounded like you were."
"I wasn't. I was..." "Do you actually expect me to have your dinner ready for you on the table when you get home?"
"No."
"Do you think I spend the day preparing for your empty stomach?"
"No."
"Do you think I have nothing better to do with my time than look after your children?"
"They're our children."
"Yes," she said. "Our children." And she roughly handed Blake to him. "The children we both made together, remember? And we are supposed to be looking after them together, except that you're not. So now I am going for a swim, and you can stay here and look after our children. Blake needs a bath. Don't forget to take Rhea's bobbles out before she goes to bed. And can you listen to the rice? It should be done soon. I'm out of here." She left the room, but immediately came back in, realizing she was still holding the dishcloth. "If you don't want me to behave like a housewife," she added, "don't treat me like one." She slammed the dishcloth down by the sink and was gone. Michael was left in the kitchen, with Blake trying to pull off his glasses, feeling deflated and misunderstood. wondering what she'd meant by listening to the rice. He was too afraid to ask her before she left, and while she was gone, he forgot about the rice entirely. Apart from once when he looked at it cooking in the pan for a while, even bent slightly to put his ear to it, acknowledging its wet, bubbling sound. It was only later, when he smelt burning, that he remembered. He ran to the cooker, dismayed, fearful for his future. Melissa returned, refreshed by her backstrokes, her shoots from the edge, her wheeling arms and watching the night sky through the slats in the ceiling of the swimming pool, all of which was quickly superseded when she discovered this new failure. Listening to rice, Michael learned that evening, means listening out for when the wet bubbling sound becomes a dry popping sound, and when it does, you're supposed to turn off the heat and put the lid on the pan. This allows the hot air to do its final intrinsic softening in the house of the rice. These were her words. Chapter 6. Multiculturalism. In case the people of Belle Green had not noticed, or not duly appreciated, the variety of nationalities and cultures living in their vicinity, the Africans and Caribbeans, the Eastern Europeans, the Indians, the Iranians, the Turks, the Nigerians, the Jamaicans, the Chinese, the Greeks, and so on. Rhea's school held an annual cultural evening in December to celebrate the rich and expansive meeting of all these disparate lands. There were folk songs and dances performed by children wearing their national dress. There were poetry readings in high-pitched voices, exploring the positivity and mellifluousness of diversity. There were comedy sketches and gospel singers, recorder recitals, and carnival choreographies, a fashion show in which adults and children alike paraded up and down the makeshift wooden catwalk in the cramped assembly hall, flaunting their far-flung fabrics, their wrappers, their saris, their head wraps, and their dashikis. In the adjacent hall was an array of international food, donated by the parents. An aromatic meeting of fufu with samosas, of moi moi and egusi stew, with tabbouleh and baklava. And while you were there, you could also get your hair braided, or your palms hennaed, or your face painted at one of the stalls, or take part in a spot of Tamil calligraphy, or Polish wichinanki. This year, there was going to be a guest appearance by a former pupil of the school, called Justin, who had been strong in music and was going to sing for them. Michael was taking Rhea to the show. It would become one of her favourite memories, she knew, walking with her tall father up the road, right at the top, left at the church, and left again in the early winter darkness. Blake would be in bed, but she wouldn't, because she was oldest and mature. And they would go up the ramp into the busy, bustling hall where her school friends would also be up late. Shanita, Shakira, Emily. They would watch the show, and afterwards, they would go into the other hall to eat crisps, custard creams, Haribos, Chupa Chups, and other things that were forbidden at that time of night. And they would peruse the stalls, and just skip and jump around. Michael would lose her in moments as she revelled in all this fun, and catch sight of her in a corner, twittering with Shakira, or negotiating jelly bean portions in the corridor with Emily. They roped him into their games and made him give them swing rides. He was the comedian father, one of those easy adults who understood the importance of playing, who could do it almost as well as them. Rhea was not taking part in the show. She preferred to watch, craning her neck and peering to get the best view. At the end of the evening, she and Michael would walk back home in the even deeper dark, the moon there, the lamplights, the quiet streets, and she would fall asleep without protest on a long, smooth slide made of joy. The preparations for the event went on for many weeks, for that time robbing the children of PE. Instead, they practiced their songs and rehearsed their dance moves, or if they weren't performing, they made the backdrop, or painted the national flags to be hung on lines of string across the ceiling. At home, the parents got costumes ready. They found wrappers, and if they did not have wrappers, they hemmed pieces of cloth to make wrappers. And if they did not have pieces of cloth, they went to Brixton or Peckham. The recent women of Africa considered what head wraps they would wear, how they would wear them, with what quiff and shape, with how much coverage of ear, half, whole, or none, depending on the sensitivity of your gristle, and whether or not you wore glasses. They talked to their less recent children, who had never been home, about how they were going to take them home one day, so that they could see the true country, where they were really from, and if they were naughty children or showing signs of possible future street gang involvement, they would focus on the educational virtues of that country and how respect for your elders and authority was an unquestionable, unnegotiable part of life on the basis of important ancient customs, and the declaration about taking them home would bear a tone of threat. Meanwhile, the peoples of the Mediterranean dug out their historical skirt, and those of the Indian subcontinent assembled little tunics and saris so that they could watch their cubs twirl around on stage, celebrating altogether the wonderful exuberance of the beige nation, which was something that just did not really occur to them on a day-to-day basis. Ria had a wrapper and matching top that Melissa had made for her to wear to a Nigerian wedding last year, but she wasn't going to wear it because she wasn't in the fashion show, and the audience didn't have to dress cultural. They could wear whatever they wanted. She was going to wear her new grey Primark jeans, the moshy monster top her grandmother on Michael's side had brought for her, her black and pink trainers, and her white puffer. And she wanted her hair all out and bushy with a hairband in it. Melissa and Michael also planned to take their children home one day, to both Nigeria and Jamaica. But these were expensive, complicated trips. Multiple vaccinations, high flight costs, out-of-school term times, a visit to the Nigeria High Commission in Northumberland Avenue, where you would have to wait in a hot, overcrowded basement for possibly hours with a lot of annoyed Nigerians, only to be told when you got to the counter that you had to come back next week. So they were going to wait until Blake was at least old enough to know where he was, and what it meant when they were there, so that they could get their money's worth of heritage awareness. Melissa did sometimes attempt to make ebba and stew. Ria always enjoyed eating it at her mother's. And Alice was eager for all of her grandchildren to eat Nigerian food, but it never tasted as good when she made it herself. She could never get the consistency of the ebba right, and the stew was not as tasty. It was such a long, drawn-out process, getting the yam and shaving off the bark and boiling it and mixing it with the garri and mashing them together in a pestle and mortar. And for what? For a subpar, second-generation travesty. So the occasions, when Melissa did make it, had become just that. Occasions. She preferred to take the children to her mother's, so that they could have the real thing. To Ria, though, it was all irrelevant. People were not black or white. They were brown, beige, or pink.
"Mummy,"
she said one afternoon on the walk home from school. That day she had been painting the Jamaican flag.
"I've got three countries in my blood. Nigeria, Jamaica, and England."
"Yes, that's right," Melissa said.
"I'm half English, a quarter Jamaican, and a quarter Nigerian."
"No, you're a quarter Nigerian, a quarter English, and half Jamaican."
"Why?"
"Because I'm half Nigerian and half English, and Daddy's completely Jamaican."
"But I want to be completely Jamaican too," Ria said. "I want to be all of them."
"You can't be all of them and only one of them at the same time. You can either be just one thing or a mixture of things. Anyway, you're British as well."
"So I'm four things?"
"No, British is your nationality. This is where you're born and bred."
"What?"
"Pardon, not what."
"Pardon?"
"What?"
"What did you say about bread?"
"Not bread that you eat. Bread means growing up."
"Oh, okay."
Then she skipped off ahead and waited at the corner opposite the church for Melissa to approach with the pram, at which point she jumped out spectacularly in front of Blake with her arms in a flourish and her mouth wide open and made him laugh. His laughter was a new toy, and she did everything she could to make it go. Every day, they did this walk, other children skipping nearby with their mostly female guardians of the afternoon, They saw the same people, the short, very white girl from the estate with the large head and hard face, the slow man in the tracksuit who walked like a cat, the leopard print woman with the leopard print leggings and relaxed burgundy hair clasped at the back with a matching clip. As they walked, they talked of many things. Sometimes the hood of Rhea's coat would be balanced on her head, the arms left unused. They talked about insects.
"Ants can get under any door they like," Rhea said.
"Yes, they can," Melissa replied.
"Flies can't. They're too big. What if lots of flies wanted to crawl on me? I like it when flies crawl on me."
"Do you? I don't."
"I do. What if a line of flies was queuing up to crawl on me?"
She laughed.
"Not all over me, though. I wouldn't like to have flies crawling all over me, especially on a hot day. Mummy, why do flies like bins?"
They talked about the Queen.
"My friend Alia said she's been to Buckingham Palace and met the Queen and stayed there for a month. She had to wash her feet."
"Whose feet?"
"The Queen's feet, and scratch her feet as well, and wash up and cook her dinner. She had to do loads of stuff. I can't remember all of it. I think I should start learning to cook."
They talked about ghosts.
"Mummy, do you want to die peacefully or not peacefully?"
"I definitely want to die peacefully."
"I don't."
"But why not?"
"Because then I won't get to come back as a ghost. It would be fun being a ghost. You get to stay up late all the time."
"And the perils of Coke?"
"If you drink Coke, it makes your teeth shrink. If you drink it every day, then after about 2 or 3 days, all your teeth shrink smaller and smaller, and then they just fall out. My friend told me."
From the corner opposite the church, they could see the Crystal Palace Tower in the distance, beyond the rooftops and treetops and telephone wires. And they talked about that palace too.
"You know, in Crystal Palace Park, there used to be a massive big palace made of glass, and it got set on fire and burnt down."
"Yes," Melissa said, "in 1936.
"How did you know?"
"I read it in that book we got from the library." Rhea had recently done a school project on it. "Do you know about the train as well?"
"What train?"
"The one that got stuck in the tunnel with the people inside it."
"What? Did they all die?"
"Probably. If it's true, that is."
"That means there must be ghosts there. Can we go to Crystal Palace Park and see one day?"
"Okay." Rhea had inherited Melissa's wanderlust. They were adventurers, explorers. It was not just talk. They would go and see.
"When?"
she said.
"Soon.
I think you can get to the tunnel entrance through the woods. It's sealed, though, so we won't be able to go in. Just look."
"Okay."
The houses either side of them, the red stone witch hat terraces, the gardens, the stony driveways, the silver birches, the estate. There, they turned left and came down Paradise Row, along the bend, across the road to their line of Victorians, with number 13 halfway down, and the high road at the bottom, where the sirens ripped crazily through the air. They were a constant presence, their endless wail of trouble. Like Stephanie, Melissa did not want Rhea and Blake to grow up with this sound, to develop the hardness that enabled you to become insensitive to it. She wanted them to live somewhere calmer, somewhere greener, somewhere the emergency services were less busy, so that they, in turn, could be calm and keep the purity of themselves. She was aware that in the area in which she chose to live, in walking Rhea to school, taking Blake to the park, to the local shops, in the things they came across on these journeys, she was assembling their childhoods, building their store of memory. Would Rhea remember the sirens? Would she remember the day they walked home from school and the road opposite the church was blocked off by white ribbons? That day, Melissa went to pick her up as usual at 3:30 p.m. They went to the administration office to give in a reply slip, then exited through the school gates. They crossed the road, turned right, turned the bend, playing a game of I Spy. But when they reached the church, they had to stop. There was a white cordon ribbon blocking the way. Another was fluttering in the wind further along, while inside the two ribbons was a police van and several policemen standing about. A group of onlookers had gathered by the church. It was not difficult to guess what had happened. There had been a shooting, right there at the top of Paradise Row, at 3:35 p.m., as children were walking home from school. To address the problem of women's equality, Blake had started going to a childminder twice a week, Rhea's friend Shanita's auntie. She was a loud, buxom Jamaican with a red weave. She said, "Hi there, sweet boy," snatching him out of Melissa's arms at the front door. He didn't like being left, and he cried a lot. She could still hear him crying as she walked away, feeling lopsided, as if she had misplaced something very important. Blake was more attached to her than Rhea had been. She felt that in leaving him there she was tampering with the natural order of things, depriving herself of an offering, a new direction. She looked back at the house and regretted that she would not know the tissues of his day, the tissues used to wipe his nose, and the tissues of his new mind experiencing moments. Michael said, "He'll be fine. He'll settle." "How do you know?" "He will. He has to." In the second week, he cried less and set a brave face when the door was closed. But Melissa still rushed to him when the day was over, desperate to reclaim him. "How do you manage it?" she said. "Spending so much time away from him. You see him for a minute in the morning and 2 minutes in the evening. Doesn't it bother you? Don't you feel bad? Is this just a woman thing?" "It's different for you. You're his mum." "Well, you're his dad." "I know, but..." During that walk to the Cobb's Corner roundabout in the mornings and the ride on the 176, everything fell from Michael's consciousness. The house, the baby, the dust, the draining board and whether it was full or not. The world was distraction and extraction from smaller worlds. It was getting more and more between them, this imbalance, the hours spent with and without. It was another presence, darkening and becoming solid. "Your life hasn't changed," she said.
"My life has changed. How can you say my life hasn't changed?"
"How? Tell me." And he told her about the after-work drinks he didn't go to, the meetups he couldn't make, the rush to get home every evening so that he could be ordered in an unfriendly tone to listen to Rice. He did not like this Melissa with the hard mouth and loveless eyes. He wanted the other Melissa, that old, original Melissa, with the soft and skyward face, the gentle, dreaming eyes. Where had she gone?
"Okay," he said angrily. "How about you get on the 176 at 7:35 every morning instead? You're never satisfied. You go out to work then, and I'll stay here."
"I do work," she said. "I don't need your money. I can make my own money." This exchange took place at the intersection between the living room and dining room, beneath the ecclesiastical arch. Melissa standing at the bottom of the stairs, Michael sitting on the sofa in front of the TV. Afterwards, Melissa went upstairs without saying goodnight, and Michael poured himself another glass of red wine. When he lay down next to her later in the red room, he thought to encircle her in the way of the old palace days, but she was all closed to him, breathing deeply on their ship, as if their bodies had never belonged to one another. In the morning, he got up before her. Blake called for his mother, and he lay him next to her in the place that he had just vacated. He put on the grey suit. Before leaving, he went to say goodbye to Rhea. She was awake, lying on her back. He sat down next to her.
"Hi, Daddy," she said.
"Hey."
"It's Thursday today."
"I know."
"And you know what that means?"
"I know what that means."
"Can you stay with me for a minute?"
"Okay, a minute."
"A long minute."
"I've got to go to work now."
"But it's too early."
"I'm going to a breakfast meeting."
A breakfast meeting? What's a breakfast meeting? Do you eat your breakfast together with lots of other people or something? With different cereals?
Yeah, kind of. And talk about work.
Oh.
Rhea pondered this.
I don't like breakfast meetings. I think you should have your breakfast first at home and then go to work and talk about it there. You're always at work, Daddy.
Michael laughed. I know, but them's the breaks. It was a holiness, the sight of this child. She had a power over him that no one else had. She washed him clean of any darkness, any disappointment or yearning. With this holiness in the palm of his hand, he stroked the side of her head and her rich hair. I'll see you tonight, he said. Rhea beamed. Multiculturalism was nigh.
Tonight? I can't wait.
A goosey was stewing, chapatis were frying, rice was steaming, and plantain was undressing. Later that day, the tables in the second hall were pulled into place, making loud scrapes across the parquet floor. The flags of the world were hoisted on their strings across the ceiling of the first hall, and rows of child-sized blue plastic chairs were laid out for the audience, with the piano set just so at an angle to the stage. Across bell-green, traditional outfits were ironed and final checked, and the light was falling early in its new frame of mind. It was not yet winter, but the season was already underway on this island of eager coolness. The green chandeliers of the birch trees were gone, their arms naked above their stoic white trunks. Snow was coming. You could feel it. In the knife of the air, in the rip of the breeze. It was almost dark when Rhea came home from school. It was thick and deep by the time she'd eaten dinner and changed into her uncultural clothes. She unleashed her hair. She chose her Hello Kitty hairband. She put on her socks. She put her things into her fuchsia felt bag and waited eagerly for Michael to get home. After the breakfast meeting, Michael went to the office and passed the girl at reception with the beautiful eyes and said hey. Now they always said hey. He hey, she hi. He even knew her name, Rachel, because they had found themselves in the lift together one day and he had said, Michael, offering his hand. And she had said, Rachel, accepting it, and the discomfort of avoiding each other was thereby resolved. He worked through lunch so that he could leave early to get back for the show. On his desk, he had a picture of Rhea and Blake, which he looked at periodically and got a warm and purposeful feeling from. At 4:45 p.m, he cleared away his things and headed for the door, and he would have got back in time if it had not been for a number of things, as he tried to explain to Melissa later that evening. First of all, this is the bit he didn't try to explain, he ran into Rachel in the lift again and they got chatting about cricket. Her father, it turned out, was once a national player in New Zealand, where she interestingly had lived until she was 10 before moving to England. And Michael, of course, had played lots of cricket when he was a teenager, so there was much to enthuse about. The white running, the flight of a ball, full of chance, the seeking in the arm. They carried on talking as they left the lift and walked through the lobby together, during which he noticed how pleasingly tall she was and how her hair smelt nice, flowery, and it turned out that she also was leaving for the day. So he waited, just very briefly, for her to get her bag from the island, and they carried on out the door, shoulder to shoulder, even walked a little way through the streets together, until they parted on Charing Cross Road, next to one of London's last red telephone boxes. For a moment there, he had felt like John Legend, in sunglasses, in Washington, D.C., walking out with his forbidden woman, and it had given him a thrill. Another pinch of yearning doubt about where he was in the get-lifted narrative. Who was she, inside? This Rachel, this fellow aficionado of cricket. He looked back at her as she walked away, her leather handbag tapping against her hip, her thick legs and that slightly heavy walk. What might she feel like, touch like, be like in her newness? How might it be? Those eyes,
The luxuriance of them. Such depth. Such gold. And then he had the most horrendous journey home. He waited ages for the 176, he told Melissa. Ages and ages. 20 minutes at least. In the deepening city-lit darkness. But it didn't come. Which is very unusual for the 176, and indicative of the unusual, somehow, otherworldly nature of this particular journey home. So he had no choice but to get the tube. Who gets a bus anyway, from central London to the deep south, during rush hour? Melissa interjected as he was telling her this. He ran. For now, it was 5:40. The show started at 6:30. To the crowded tube entrance at Charing Cross, bracing himself as he began to descend from the safety of the upper air into the claustrophobia of the lower air, the tunnels, the dreaded tunnels, stretching and shooting through miles of dirt, populous with all kinds of incontinent vermin, susceptible, he could not help but imagine, to disastrous collapse and random bombings, as demonstrated by 7-7, which had marked the beginning of his serious tube boycott. The stairs were crowded. The ticket hall was teeming. There were wide walkers everywhere. The name he gave to people who wade rather than walk, or have bags on either side of them, or have some other kind of inconsiderately expansive gait. He finally got through the barriers and down the escalator onto the southbound Northern Line platform, only to find that also was crowded. Two trains went by before he could even get on. Same thing at Waterloo, where he changed to the Jubilee line, though thankfully the one he did get on was less crowded, and there was at least some room to breathe. He stood there, bound for London Bridge, listening to Jill Scott on his iPod, reading the ads above the windows, studying the tube map, looking at the people around him, but too anxious to play the "Where are they going?" game. The man with the guitar in the suede shoes, another man with bright green eyebrows who kept opening and closing a piece of paper and mouthing words from it. He found that if he focused on these small things, the suede shoes, the green eyebrows, he could cope better with the problem of being under the pavement. Though what he was predominantly thinking about was Ria, waiting at home for him, the minutes going by. 5:54. 5:56. 5:58. At 5:59, as if purposefully to madden him, somewhere in the blackness past Southwark, the tube came to a gradual, infuriating halt. Darkness unfolded. The silence was total. No word from the driver. Sighs, tuts, shufflings, teeth kissings. Michael started to sweat. People were rubbing their necks, scratching, folding their arms. From somewhere further along the tunnel, there was a tremor. From somewhere closer, there came a jolt. People glanced at each other. Another jolt. Closer still. A door at one end of the carriage opened, and a man stepped in, wearing a dirty coat and emitting a bad smell. Holding on to the two poles where the seats began, he cleared his throat and gave the following speech.
"Now, listen for a minute," he said. "I'm not a drunk or a junkie or anything. I'm unemployed. Got a sick wife to support. Lost my job last year. Then became homeless because I couldn't keep up the bills. Now, as I said, I don't drink or take drugs. I'm just going through a rough patch, you know? We all have rough patches. If I'm going to eat and feed my family this evening, I have to raise £6. I ain't got no money. But there's enough of you here to help me eat, even by giving me just a few pennies each. Oh, I don't do this all the time, honest, only when there's nowhere else to go. Thank you for listening, and if you can't hear me, you don't want to hear me."
He shuffled through the carriage, holding out a bag for people to drop their pennies into, which a few of them did, more so towards the other end of the carriage. Michael gave him £2. The train moved off again. The beggar went into the next car, and at last they arrived at London Bridge, where Michael shot out through the open doors, weaved through the wide walkers, oh, so many wide walkers, up the escalator, through what seemed like a series of more and more tunnels and walkways, so that it began to feel as if he were going nowhere, and would never get anywhere, ever again. He passed a busker who was playing Aaron Neville's Hercules on the guitar, and another busker playing a flute, the silver trail of sound suddenly making him think of Gillian. He was running now, up the final escalator, and then, after all that, he told Melissa, he had to wait 10 minutes for an overground train, that is, an actual train, as opposed to a tube, to take him to the London the tube forgot. It was not until 7 o'clock that he was running down the high street, gripping his Oyster card, past the chicken shops and the pound shops, towards Paradise Row, full of a violent, stomach-churning guilt that Rhea had missed the beginning of multiculturalism, and it was all his fault. To his surprise, the house was empty. This is because 40 minutes earlier, sacrificing the evening order of the Gina Ford bedtime and thoroughly piqued, Melissa had gathered up Blake, put his bodysuit over his pyjamas, put him into the pram, and the three of them, she, Rhea, and Blake, had gone up Paradise Row in the dark and the cold, right at the top, left at the church up the slope, and into the brimming first hall, where they found a seat in the fifth row and waited for the show to start. The pianist was in position. The stereo was playing High Life. The children who were performing were sitting on the floor in front of the stage, while their mothers, fathers, aunties, uncles or grandparents were sitting in the rows of chairs behind them, their buttocks, some denimed, some legginged, splurging over the edges. The room was hot and getting hotter. As the chairs filled up and more people gathered, standing at the back, leaning against the climbing frames along the walls, or watching from out in the corridor when there was no space left in the hall, as Michael did when he arrived halfway through the show. All the windows were open and misty with steam. There was a feeling of bright, accepting chaos, of gushy expectation, the smells of many stews drifting in from the second hall. Presently, the headmistress, Mrs. Beverly, stepped up onto the stage with her grey cornrowed crown, her cultural effort of kente dashiki top and fishtail wrapper, with fluorescent orange sling-back heels. She had squinty, bespeckled eyes, and always lurched forward when she spoke in a mode of grand compassion. The audience quietened. She pressed her hands together and thanked everyone for coming. "I am always so impressed with our children, and all you dedicated parents who make the effort to come to our shows every year," she said, her earnest eyes blinking. "It really makes it all worth it, doesn't it, children?" And she swept an affectionate gaze at the ones waiting and assenting below her. "Now, the children, as you know, have been working very hard to prepare for tonight, learning their songs and helping to decorate this hall. Doesn't it look wonderful?" The audience agreed that indeed it did. Blake did not agree because he was starting to cry. Melissa bounced him up and down on her knee, while Mrs. Beverly asked everyone to switch off their mobile phones and to extract overwhelmed infants from the hall if they really weren't happy. She finished her speech with a request for some encouraging applause for the opening act, and the performance began. First up were two young Tamil dancers in red and turquoise saris, biting their lips and looking at each other. As the music played, they span and bent, letting their viscose fabric flow, then rose up again and checked what the other was doing to see if they were doing it right. Too frightening it was to smile out at the audience or attempt eye contact, their mothers and fathers, and possibly especially their mothers, being the most frightening people of all to be studied by in public, so there was a complete absence of audience-performer connection, which made them more endearing. "Ah, bless 'em," said a woman next to Melissa, who was sitting next to the one from the estate with a large head. The Tamil dancers were followed by a gospel song from the school choir, then a middle-aged Greek solo dancer, somebody's mother, in a traditional dress with frills at the front, embroidered hems of aubergine velvet, and short puffy sleeves, accessorized by green sequin gloves to the elbow and a pair of tight gold pumps on her chubby feet. She was a stark contrast to her dancing predecessors, with her absolute lack of shyness and her ball-like, charging movements. Every time she did a skirt-lifting spin or something flourishing and climatic with her sequined arms, the audience clapped. She had a white flower in her hair and a black clip. Her musical accompaniment was throaty and substantial, thick with guttural strings and a heavy continental bass. During her performance, she began to sweat. It glistened in the emerging wrinkles of her forehead and darkened her armpits, but she continued unabashed until the music reached the peak of its crescendo, and she finished, victorious, one knee on the floor and arms extended. There was a blast of applause from the crowd, honoring the bravado and luster of her performance, her commitment to celebrating life whatever your age, and setting a shining example to the children. It's never too late. Live. Live completely. Dance like no one's watching. After this came the Trinidadian Carnival Troupe, then a recital of a poem by Benjamin Zephaniah. The final act was Justin, the ex-pupil who had come to sing, though, it turned out, not as well as people were expecting, considering the build-up. He was given a magnanimous introduction by Mrs. Beverly, and a round of applause as he climbed the steps to the stage, wearing an ordinary white polo shirt and Adidas trainers. He walked with his head tipped back, as if he were about to ask the world a question. There was no overture to his song. He did not smile or speak, merely took hold of the mic with both hands, looked blankly ahead, and delivered a crucifying rendition of Robbie Williams's Angels. He put that song on a hard black nail and mounted it to a deathly cross on a dark and desolate hill, where it died slowly over many long and painful bars. "Oh my God, who told that boy he could sing?" the woman next to Melissa said. He was no legend, not even a Robbie, and when he had finished, the relief was palpable. The people who had been trying to close their ears invisibly by using the muscles inside them could relax again. They sat back and watched the fashion show, frills and fabrics swishing up and down, the earless ladies in head wraps. Michael took Rhea to Wichananki, hair threading, fufu sampling, henna palming, and Haribo munching afterwards, while Melissa went home in a huff with Blake. Later, he would explain the horrendous journey home, complete with the Hercules busker and tunnel pause, but she was icy with him. Definitely no Desdemona. Was Desdemona dead, and all of her offshoots? It went on like this. They fell to distances. Her body forgot his hands. They were partners, in the very tedious sense of the word. And the difficult thing was that they couldn't talk to their best friends about it, because they had been each other's best friends. One night, Melissa called her friend Hazel instead. "I need to go shopping," she said. "Me too." "You always need to go shopping." Hazel was always beautifully dressed. Probably even now, on this gloomy Sunday evening, she was sitting in her swinging designer wicker chair in a dress and lady slippers. "Life is cloth," she said. "I believe you. Retail therapy works every time." "Why? What's wrong?" "Nothing." "Oh, really? So when are you free?" "Next Saturday." "Okay." "Okay." And they arranged to meet at Topshop. Chapter 7. Desdemona. "I don't understand women sometimes," Michael said to Damien. "Me neither," said Damien. "Like the other night, I went to give her a hug, and you know what she said?"
"What?"
"She said, you just want me to service you."
"Service?
As in petrol. She's Esso, I'm the tank. I'm not a tank," I told her.
"And what did she say?"
"She said you are. All men are tanks. You use women like fuel. You come home and expect me to be lying there waiting for you wearing Ann Summers underwear."
"And what did you say?"
"I said, that's not true. I was just showing a little love and affection, remember that?" And she goes, "Yes, you want to be loved passionately your whole life, don't you?" And I said, "Well, yes, I do. What's wrong with that?"
"And what did she say?"
"She said, I need to get real. And life ain't like that anymore. And it can't run like that now. I don't know what's happened to her, man. It's like she's turning into a different person."
"Maybe it's postnatal depression. Stephanie had that after Summer was born. It makes them crazy. You just have to go with it and be meek."
"Meek?"
"Yeah.
I don't want to be meek."
"I know, but it's the only way."
"God."
So how did you leave it? She went to bed, then I went to bed.
The same bed?
No, I slept on the sofa.
There was a grave silence at the seriousness of this disclosure. They were in the Satay Bar in Brixton on a Friday night, having an after-work drink. They had initially met at the station and walked down to the arcade to find a bar, but they were alarmed at the lack of black people in there. They were nowhere to be seen. It was as if they had been shooed away into small, dark mouse holes where the buildings met the street. So Michael had said, "Cha, man, let's go to the Satay." And here they were, a fuchsia glow at the glitzy end of Cold Harbour Lane, opposite Kentucky, around the corner from the Ritzy Cinema, meeting point for dancing at Plan B. It was one of the few places in Brixton that had triumphed against the bleaching conquest of gentrification. It was full of weaved women, dressed to the maximum in shimmer tops and cute jackets and silky dresses, their hair flowing smoothly from their fibbing scalps, their fingernails dynamic. This was a place you made an effort for. Guys too, well-snipped, best denim. Musculature optimized if applicable. Damien felt conspicuously lame and provincial in his bad suit. Michael was wearing a suit as well, but his was a better cut, a slick faint navy, more fitted, and there was only half of it. He was wearing jeans and a trendy belt, and his stomach didn't bulge out against the belt the way Damien's did. They had discussed before the wearing of the suit and how they felt about it. Damien could never seem to pull it off. The shoulders were always a bit too wide for him and the trousers too tight, and no matter where he bought the suit, it always looked like it came from Blue Ink on Oxford Street. Although he claimed also to struggle, Michael did not share these failings. He power-dressed, powerfully. He had swagger. For him, it seemed effortless, like many other things. In order to attend to the issue of his ailing mental health, as Stephanie thought of it, Damien was trying to spend more time in London to reconnect with himself, and it was his idea to meet up tonight. What a relief it was to walk along Brixton Road in the evening hubbub, and to be sitting here now in these cosy leather armchairs, next to the bar with a good friend and a bowl of wasabi nuts and Roy Ayres playing from the speakers. It made him yearn again for his former life, and the dangerous thing was that the feasibility of returning to that life seemed less impossible, sitting here with Michael than it ever did in Dorking. He could get a studio flat somewhere, he was thinking. It wouldn't have to be anything fancy, just a roof over his head. He could visit Stephanie and the children at weekends, finish his novel. Surely in London he would finish it. Maybe even get a publishing deal. The idea of it was making him sweat, as was the bad pleasure he was feeling at Michael pouring out his heart to him like this. All was not well in M&M Paradise. He was enjoying every word. "It's oppressing me now, this relationship," Michael was saying. He was on his second whiskey. "Sometimes I feel like walking out, like not going home after work. Just go in somewhere else instead."
"Like where?"
"I don't know. To a hotel? A club? Just somewhere."
"But that's the thing," Damien said. "There isn't anywhere. It's a fantasy." At least this was the theory he tried to live by.
"It is? Isn't it?"
"You know, the one thing that stops me from leaving," Michael said. "The kids. I want to be with my kids, man. I want to be there when they wake up. I want to smell their morning breath."
"Yeah, I know. It's all about the kids."
"But it shouldn't be all about the kids. I don't want to live like that either." Melissa did have a point, Damien thought, about Michael needing to get real. Marriage, it was all about the kids. He himself had accepted this a long time ago, that children claim the love. They change it. They drink it. They offer it back to you in a sticky cup, and it never quite tastes the same. The romantic love from which they sprang becomes an old, disheveled garden, visited on rare occasions, fueled by wine and spurts of spontaneity. And the bigger, family love is where the bloom and freshness lie. But Michael and Melissa were not married. That was the difference. They had not crossed that line, and Michael could keep on walking without paper. And he could look around at all these fit, shimmering women, as he was now, intermittently, particularly at the one on the table over there in the ivory dress, who was looking back at him,
and wonder at other futures, more experience, more pleasure. Damien did not dare look at them. If he looked at them, really looked at them, he would be faced with the ugly and excruciating abstinence of his own life. Michael turned from the honeys and stared into his drink with deepening bleakness. He wanted Melissa, not them, but he didn't know how to get to Melissa anymore. He was stuck. It was hard to stay and hard to go. "What do you do?" he said. "When you reach a point where you know it's just not going to work out with someone, it's never going to be good again, what do you do, huh? You have to make a decision, right? You accept unhappiness or you do something different. I've been thinking about this a lot." He moved his drink to the side of the table and drew a square with his finger. "There's a window. This is the window. Everyone at some point in their lives is faced with this window. And in the window, you can choose not to become what you seem to be becoming. You can take a leap, do something off the wall, something reckless. It's your last chance, and most people miss it. They just walk past it. Then one day it closes, and once it's closed forever. This moment right here with Melissa, this is my window. I can either risk it and jump, or stay where I am." "But could you jump?" Damien said. "Do you have the courage to jump?" Michael pondered, sighed. "I'm such a coward." They drank from their glasses, both looking through this metaphorical window, which for Damien was closed, or was it? And for Michael was still open. "When are you two going to get married? This long engagement is one long engagement." It had been announced in the closing embers of the last century. There had been the meeting of respective families, the gathering of friends, champagne, cashew nuts, then nothing. The century turned. Babies. A house. What were they waiting for? They should just damn well get married and put the nail in the coffin like everybody else. "I think we've missed that boat," Michael said. "It's never too late." "Ain't gonna happen." "Have you ever thought that might be half your problem?" Damien said, energized, calling on a line of reasoning he employed often with some doubt. "That you haven't taken that step together, that final step. You haven't fully committed. The grass on the other side is still available to you. You think it's greener, but it's not. You're torturing yourselves, man. Just close the door, seal it shut, and get on with your lives. Deal with what you've got in it."
"That sounds like a really dry reason to get married," Michael said,
at which point Damien felt belittled and stripped of the protection of his reasoning and a bit irritated, and wanted to do something mildly violent like poke him in the eye.
"Do you and Stephanie ever fight?"
"Yep."
"I can't imagine you fighting."
"We do it by not talking."
Which ranks high on the list of dangerous domestics, close to the exit door. When you are only tolerating each other, avoiding each other, becoming to one another mist, vapour, ether. Damien went to work. Stephanie took the kids to school and went to work. In the evenings, they put the children to bed and did their own thing. All was not well in D and S land either. Though Damien was less open about it, there seemed more at stake. He was not exactly contemplating divorce, but last week, while Stephanie was putting the colander in the kitchen cupboard, and he saw her bending down like that with her shoulders all thrown into it, and the side of her face flushed from the kitchen heat, then standing up and leaning on the edge of the counter, just at that moment, he had felt like being perfectly and devastatingly honest and saying, "I can no longer live this life, and I am going to go and save myself." But of course he didn't. He couldn't. The evening passed. The next day came, and things went on as normal. "If you entertain and act on every impulse that passes through your mind," went his line of reasoning, "you will find yourself in chaos. Hold on to the things that bind you. The self is a doomed and wayward creature. It can be neglected, and this will not kill you, at least not in every way." Stephanie had said to Damien the night before last,
"Get a therapist. That's what people do when they're depressed. It's not something to be ashamed of."
And Damien had said,
I'm not depressed.
Oh, really?
Stephanie drawled with her now frequent sarcasm.
Well, I beg to differ.
Her well of comfort and support was running out. Exhausted were the don't shut me outs and I'm here if you want to talks and blah blah blahs. Wrung out and stiff were the soothing cloths of cool water to mop his brow through this momentous time of bereavement and adult orphanness. It was time for psychology, for she herself was not adequately trained, and there was only so much a wife could do to help when her husband had turned into a ghost, when he spent entire evenings sitting at the computer, looking at random websites, or whatever he was doing. Sometimes with horses that won't drink, you have to just drag them to the water and dunk their face in it. Forget about their feelings.
I have 3 children, Damien, she had said. Not 4. Please, for all our sakes, get some help.
With that, she had removed herself from the dining room, leaving behind on the table some leaflets for local counselling services that she'd picked up. Since then, she had practically ignored him, and he had ignored the leaflets, putting them on the shelf where the maps and telephone directories were kept. He couldn't imagine sitting in front of some nodding stranger in a little room with a plant and a box of tissues and unveiling his heart. It was not in his makeup. His father would never have done such a thing. He would see it as self-pitying and white. Did the slaves have access to therapy? Were they treated for post-traumatic stress disorder? No, Lawrence would opine. They got on with it and mustered strength and sang songs and drew on their spirits, and they had a whole lot more to complain about than one measly little family bereavement. They were being bereaved every day, every hour, every minute, en masse, their throats cut, their sweethearts raped, their brothers whipped, their fathers lynched. Who are you to complain? 2 weeks ago, Damien had gone to his father's flat in Stockwell to clear out the last of his belongings. The books, the African carvings, the crocodile skin shoes were now in boxes in the garage at home, waiting to be sorted through. He wasn't sure what to do with it all, and its presence there was having the effect of magnifying the feeling that he was being haunted. He'd been having absurd dreams. He dreamt that he was in an airport, and he had to catch a plane, and he was running, but his suitcase was too heavy, and when he opened it, he found his father inside. But he was a boy instead of a man. There was an unnerving instant last week when Summer, who bore a striking resemblance to Lawrence, had looked at him in a particular way, and it had seemed exactly as if Lawrence had come to say hello to him in her face. And then just now, on the walk from the arcade to the satay bar, crossing Railton Road with Michael, a chilling moment of déjà vu. On that same street, about a year ago, he had been walking towards Brixton Station after a meeting, when he had seen coming towards him a shabby old man in dirty jeans and a threadbare denim jacket, his hair wild and matted, his face long and haggard, a hopeless, wayward gait, almost like a drunk. It was Lawrence. He hadn't recognized him at first, his own father. When he did recognize him, he was shocked and embarrassed for them both. They shook hands. They stood there for a while, trying to have a conversation, but it was stilted. And after a few minutes, Lawrence had walked on, watching him go. Damien's strongest thought was that he would never, ever end up like that. He would never become a penniless, staggering drifter of a man whose own son did not recognize him. It occurred to him now that Lawrence must have